This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the finances and accountability, or lack of it, in Michigan's charter school system was the subject of a recent Detroit Free Press series. We'll hear from Western Michigan University professor Gary Miron, who has studied and written about charter schools in Michigan and other states. But first, the idea of a carbon tax to address climate change. The Citizens Climate Lobby says that taxing carbon emissions would decrease greenhouse gases and help grow the U.S. economy. Recently, the Citizens Climate Lobby launched a chapter in Kalamazoo. Dana Maines of Fenville is the leader of the CCL's Kalamazoo chapter. Dana Maines, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Hi, thank you for having me on your program today.
Tell us a little bit about the background of the Citizens Climate Lobby.
Well, the Citizens Climate Lobby, it's a nonprofit, nonpartisan, a grassroots organization. We're committed to creating the political will for a livable world. We advocate for federal climate legislation, specifically a revenue-neutral carbon tax, also known as fee and dividend. Under this carbon tax, 100% of revenue is returned to American households. And I just want to say that again because it makes this unique. It's 100% of the revenue from this carbon tax is returned to American households. So it's a climate solution that can rapidly cut greenhouse gas emissions while adding jobs to the economy. So I'm just one of over 5,000 volunteers. We're really just regular people from diverse backgrounds that care deeply about the climate crisis, and we want to be engaged in getting the urgent policies we need at the national level.
And how did you get involved specifically?
Well, I learned about Citizens Climate Lobby through following the leading climate scientist, James Hansen. And he always recommends Citizens Climate Lobby at the end of his talks. And I am personally passionate about the issue as a new mom. I have a beautiful 2-year-old daughter, Grace, and she keeps me really busy when I'm not at my day job working at Fenville Adult Alternative High School. And she's my true motivation to do this work. I know I have to step up and do whatever I can, even if it means getting outside of my comfort zone, like doing a radio interview like this or going to meet with my members of Congress. One day I have to be able to look her in the eye and tell her that I tried my best to protect her future. And if your listeners have followed the science, they know that our current trajectory of emissions and climate impacts is dire. We really have a small window of opportunity to stop catastrophic climate change from accelerating out of control and reaching a point that civilization can't manage or adapt.
Let's talk a little bit more about the idea of a carbon tax. Why do you think that is the best way to address climate change?
Well, the carbon tax approach, it has to be well-designed and it has to be revenue neutral. That is, it has to recycle all of the revenue back to American households. And it is right now the best solution out there for effectively cutting emissions at the levels needed to stay at the 2-degree target for additional warming to keep to our carbon budget, while at the same time actually improving the economy and adding jobs. So I could just explain briefly how this revenue carbon tax works.
Please do.
It's a steadily rising price is placed on carbon at its source, so the mine or well or port of entry. In our legislation, the tax starts at $15 a ton and rises $10 a ton each year, so that clean energy is actually cheaper than fossil fuels within a decade. And again, all of the money collected is returned to American households on an equitable basis. Under the plan, 2/3 of American households would break even or even receive more in their monthly dividend check than they would pay in added energy costs. So it protects the poor and middle class, and a predictably rising carbon price sends a really clear market signal that will unleash entrepreneurs and investors in the new clean energy economy. And really important as well is the border tariff adjustment that protects U.S. businesses and makes the policy truly international in scope.
So we would actually be getting a check, those of us in the United States, we would actually get a check sent to us every month under this plan?
Yes, that's the good news, and that's what makes this policy actually stimulate the economy and creates jobs, because we could expect to see for a family of four, let's say two adults and two children, children receive a half share, adults receive a full share. In the first 10 years, so by 2025, the annual dividend would be about $3,480, which is $288 a month. And by 2035, it would be about $396 a month. And so that is what will offset the rising costs of energy. And if you're really good at cutting your carbon emissions and footprint, you can save even more money and come out way ahead.
Let's talk a little bit about this report by Regional Economic Models Incorporated. What does this show about how the carbon tax would work and what effect it would have on the economy?
Yes, this is a very comprehensive and groundbreaking study that Climate Lobby has just released on June 9th. And REMI, short for Regional Economics Modeling Incorporated, as you said, is it's a nonpartisan, totally apolitical economic modeling firm that's conducted studies since 1980 for an impressive list of clients in government, business, and the nonprofit community. REMI run the study on the tax applied to carbon content of fossil fuels, like I had described. And the key findings of the study are that in the first 10 years, carbon emissions are reduced 33% and 52% in 20 years. So that's huge. Electricity generation from coal is phased out by 2025. And then the first 10 years, 2.2 million jobs would be added to the economy. Between 80 and 90 billion is added to the annual gross domestic product. And real income per capita goes up. Also, a very important added benefit is because of reduced air pollution, 13,000 lives are saved annually. And the REMI report looked at nine regions of the United States. And employment actually goes up in all of the regions. And the largest addition of jobs is actually in our region, the Eastern North Central, with 400,000 additional jobs.
How does a carbon tax help lead to more jobs?
Well, by recycling the revenue back to American households, people have more money in their pockets, more consumer spending, leads to more labor-intensive jobs and service industries, retail, and it's also stimulating a huge growth in wind and solar and clean energy, energy conservation, and related jobs.
So is there an assumption built in that there's going to be enough energy created by those alternative sources, solar, wind, etc., that it can make up for whatever decrease there is in the energy that comes from fossil fuels?
Right, and it's also figured that this will send a really clear market signal for the transition over to clean energy, and also for people to change their behaviors and be able to consume less energy and have the incentive there to do it, and also have the money to invest in energy saving technology and, things that will help them to reduce their carbon footprint.
So does this require getting some consensus on the idea that climate change is A, real, and B, caused by human activity? Because Congressman Fred Upton, who is in the representative for your district, and this entire region of Southwest Michigan, and as chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, has said he does believe climate change is real, but he doesn't necessarily believe it's caused by human activity. Do you have to get buy-in on that before you can get people to agree that a carbon tax is needed?
It's not always necessary because just on the basis of being an important tax reformation, fixing a market error in the underpricing of fossil fuels has its own merits, and we can show the benefits of doing this carbon tax. But obviously, it doesn't serve anybody or Representative Upton or others in his party to deny or question the overwhelming scientific consensus on human-driven climate change. The latest reports from the UN International Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and the National Climate Assessment just released. These are consensus-based scientific collaborations that present rigorous data, our best understanding of global warming with a very high degree of certainty. And the reports are warning that human-driven climate change is already having dramatic health, ecological, and financial impacts in every part of the world, and it will only get worse in the coming decades. By their nature, these are conservative reports, and that's what makes them even more alarming, because they're really the lowball estimate. And the IPCC report says that under current emissions trajectories or business as usual, we're headed towards 4 to 5 degrees Celsius warming by the end of the century. That's about 9 degrees Fahrenheit. And we could expect to see breakdown in agriculture and food systems, increasing number and intensity of heat waves, storms, droughts, floods, wildfires, ocean acidification, and loss of biodiversity, sea level rise that will inundate coastal cities and displace millions, increase in poverty, food and water shortages, along with migrating populations that will destabilize many countries. Back to our Representative Upton, he is really in a unique position to make a difference on this issue. He is the chairman of the Energy Committee in the House.
Energy and Commerce
Committee. And he could introduce this type of legislation. You know, I really appreciate back in 2009, he was saying that climate change is a serious problem that necessitates serious solutions. He even said that he strongly believed everything must be on the table as we seek to reduce carbon emissions. So, well, here we are in 2014, and he's backing down on his position. It's like he's turning a blind eye to our future, and inaction is not an option. So we are working to present the best scientific and economic data available to our policymakers so that they can take a step forward on bringing real climate solutions to the table.
Congressman Bob Inglis, former Congressman Bob Inglis, is a supporter of the idea of a carbon tax. He was interviewed by our station last year when he was coming to Kalamazoo. Do you think that your cause has helped somewhat if you get people perhaps who were Republican office holders at one time, or would it be helped even more to get someone who is a current Republican office holder to say a carbon tax is the way to go?
Sure. There are many conservatives that embrace the free market solution, the carbon tax and dividend, like Romney's economic advisor, Greg Mankiw, former Reagan Secretary of State, George Shultz. Even Hank Paulson just published an editorial in the New York Times supporting a price on carbon to avoid surpassing critical climate tipping points. He said we need to avoid the climate bubble with a carbon tax. And there are several current conservatives that support the plan, but politically, yeah, they need to be able to have the courage to come out and be more public about it. And so we need to, as the people, support them to give them that political will that they need to come forward and support the plan.
You mentioned this is a free market solution. A lot of people would see any taxation as antithetical to the free market. Why is a carbon tax and the plan to keep it revenue neutral, why does that make it a free market approach?
Well, it's really correcting the market error of underpricing the fossil fuels. And it's a free market solution because it does not add any money to the government. All the revenues are returned to American households.
Dana, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Dana Maines is the group leader for the Kalamazoo chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Links with more information about the Citizens Climate Lobby can be found at WMUK.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Questions about charter schools in Michigan have been raised in a Detroit Free Press series which examines the transparency and money which is spent on the academies. Gary Miron is a professor of education leadership, research, and technology at Western Michigan University. He is quoted in the Free Press series and has spent many years studying and reporting on charter schools in Michigan as well as other states. Gary Miron, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Gordon.
The Free Press found little transparency, despite the fact that there's about $1 billion a year in taxpayer money which is spent on charter schools in Michigan. And I suppose the first question someone might have when they read that figure is, how does it get to that point?
It gets there gradually, but it's that that finding is largely connected with involvement of the for-profit education management organizations, or EMOs, and they have grown pretty rapidly and over the years. Our own data set, we find that 79% of the state's charter schools are now operated by for-profit management companies, another 10% operated by nonprofit education management organizations. And so that leaves just about 10% of the schools that are what we would call independent or mom-and-pop charter schools, which was the charter school idea, that they would be small, independent, and locally run schools.
79%. You say in Michigan, run by for-profit corporations.
That's correct.
How does that compare with other states?
Other states are racing to catch up, but seriously, they are far behind. We can look at Ohio and Florida, which are two states that have increasing numbers of for-profit companies operating their schools. And there we see percentages lying between 35 and 50% of the schools run by for-profit companies. So they're far behind Michigan. Michigan is clearly an anomaly in the nation.
One of the Free Press stories, the one that you're specifically quoted in, concerned the governing boards of these schools. What sort of oversight do they have? What sort of powers do they have to address problems if they find them?
The key is really the oversight of the charter schools, and it really lies with the charter school boards. These boards are public boards. They have fiduciary responsibility. They are legally responsible for their school, and they do two things. They represent their charter school, their public charter school, and they represent the taxpayers of Michigan, and they represent and protect those interests. And what we often see is that the management company, because the management company starts the school, it handpicks and prepares a list of people that will be on the board, hands that to the authorizer who grants the charter. They approve that list. And so that the way the board is selected by the management company often means that these are people who are, they may not fully understand their responsibilities, or they may be close friends of people within the management company itself. So they don't always have an arm's length agreement. They often don't feel the need or understand the need for doing due diligence when they review contracts or other things that the school engages in. The board is important. It has to have transparency. And as this series in the Free Press revealed, that often these boards don't have access to evidence and documentation. If they don't have information, they can't take decisions. They can't do due diligence. We see increasing numbers of charter school boards who are filing lawsuits against their management companies, trying to access financial information. How is the money being spent? And the management companies simply say, it's proprietary. It's private. You don't need to know that. All you know is that you signed an agreement and that we're gonna keep a 2 or 3% year in balance. The rest of the money is swept, and we're going to do our best with that money, and trust us.
Is the role of governing boards where a lot of the problems crop up in terms of lack of transparency, lack of accountability?
It's there, but it's also with the authorizers, because what we're seeing now, and the Free Press revealed that as well, is that the close relationship between these for-profit companies and the charter school authorizers. So we see instances where the authorizer steps in and fires board members that start to question the management company, that start to question and request information that the management company may not want to share with its charter school board.
Let's take a step back and explain who the authorizers are.
In Michigan, we have multiple authorizers. Most charter schools are authorized by state universities that have boards appointed by the governor. So that excludes University of Michigan, Wayne State, and Michigan State University. So most state universities are engaged in chartering. A few do not. Also, local community colleges, as well as school districts and intermediate school districts, can grant charters.
Interestingly enough, Western Michigan University would fall under what you just described there. The Board of Trustees is appointed by the governor, so not elected. But yet, Western Michigan University has not waded into charter school authorization. Do we have a good idea of why?
Yeah, and over the years, there's been pressure on Western to step up and to sponsor its fair share of charters. Western has considered it at a few different points in time. I know that. But Western has contributed extensively to the charter school reform here in Michigan, mostly because of the evaluation and research that we've done. Between 1997 and 2002, we were engaged in a number of contracts with the Michigan Department of Education to evaluate the Michigan charter school reform. Since then, my grad students and I have done extensive studies and publications on the charter schools. And in 2002, we wrote a pretty important book called What's Public About Charter Schools? And it laid out some of the issues that have come up and things that needed to be done to improve our charter schools. A whole chapter is devoted to legislative ideas and suggestions for addressing the growth of the for-profit companies. And we kind of warned back in 2002 what this reform might look like if we continue to grow and have more and more extensive, increase this involvement of the for-profit companies. And again, today we're looking at that what we wrote back in 2002, a dozen years ago, and unfortunately nobody took heed of that advice that we provided.
The Free Press did find that there are some charter schools which are innovative and have excellent academic outcomes. In your research, what do you find are the common things amongst the charter schools which you'd say are producing a quality education for the students who go there?
From 2000 to 2004, we did a national study on the correlates of success in American charter schools. And from that study, we can more scientifically look at what are those factors, not specific to Michigan, but across the nation. What we found is that stability of leadership and teachers was very important. When we had high teacher attrition, the charter schools were not performing as well. But there tended to be, we also see some relationship with the size of the reforms. We see small reforms with more oversight actually performing better. Michigan is one of those states that ramped up its reform very quickly, and we didn't get in a good oversight in time. And now it's hard after the fact to come back and regulate or provide safeguards, given the extensive involvement and influence of the charter school establishment today. It's hard to go backwards now and try to change that. But other states that have grown more slowly, they've learned from states like Michigan, and they've tried to strengthen the oversight, provide board training and other things to make sure that they function well before growing the reform.
Are there states out there that you would consider a model for how they handle the accountability and oversight of charter schools?
Yeah. Here at Western, we've been asked to do 9 different state evaluations for Michigan, for departments of ed and state boards of education. 2 states in particular, Delaware and Connecticut, we had rather positive findings. And in part, those are smaller reforms. The focus there was on quality, not on the quantity. So we saw the authorizers more actively engaged in overseeing the schools, providing support when needed, but also closing those struggling schools or schools that didn't have the transparency that the authorizers believe that the taxpayers and others deserved.
And the Free Press series points out that there are a lot of charter schools in Michigan which have shown to be underperforming, and yet that they have remained open for a long period of time.
Yes. And I think if we look at the political background, we see 2 types of charter school reforms. We see some reforms, especially when there's bipartisan support, they tend to be smaller and focus on improving the public school system by example, meaning let's have a few high-quality charter schools, they'll be innovative, and the public schools can learn from those examples. There's another set of states that tend to be more partisan legislation, and that Michigan would fall into that case. But there, the tendency is to let's grow the reform as quickly as we can. Let's get as many charter schools as we can to create a competitive effect. So I think for those policymakers that may be aware that the quality isn't there, they still believe that there could be a way to force or use charter schools as a lever for improving traditional public schools by competition.
And the idea, in part, of having charter schools compete with public schools was to give them some more freedom from regulations and to allow them to experiment a little more, correct? So how do you balance those two things, allowing them to experiment and yet also transparency and accountability on the other side?
Yeah, it's a big trade-off. Autonomy, you get this autonomy, but you're going to be more highly accountable. And here at Western, back in the 90s and the early part of this century, we did a lot of training for charter schools to help them to demonstrate accountability. We taught them these things. Unfortunately, the accountability system shifted more to a performance accountability, not a mission-driven accountability. So what we saw—
I'm sorry, can you explain the difference between performance and mission-driven?
Well, the mission-driven is that charter schools are going to be unique and mission-driven. They're going to be small and innovative, in that they would be held accountable based on their unique missions. And so they needed to create and get agreement on measurable outcomes. And then their authorizer would look at an annual report or data based on that annual, on those agreed-upon measurable outcomes. And that's how they would be held accountable. When No Child Left Behind came on board, it had those extensive testing requirements, and that all public schools, including charter schools, had to be measured by the same standardized test. And with that increasing testing, the charter schools have shifted towards teaching to the same test, and less innovation has occurred. Another factor that's impeded the innovation, however, has been the management companies. Charter schools were supposed to be small, locally run schools. With the management companies, they have a cookie-cutter approach. Their applications for charters are almost identical except for the address and the name of the school. And they can generate scores of applications very quickly. And when they operate these schools, they focus on the same brand, the same, and their models aren't very innovative. They're more back to basics. They're very much in line with what we do in traditional public schools, actually. So these management companies have been taking decisions about their schools, not locally, but sometimes across the state or across the country, and the schools look all alike. So this has also impeded any innovation that the local founders may have had.
If someone were reading this Free Press series and they're in the Michigan Department of Education or the state legislature and they say, boy, we need to make some changes, and Gary Miron's phone rang and they said, what would you suggest that we do? You would say what?
Legislation. Some people are very upset. I think the authors of those Free Press articles, they're very concerned about these for-profit companies. In a way, I guess I am too, but let's stop and think. These are for-profit companies. Should we be surprised that they're gaming the system? Should we be surprised that they're trying to maximize profit? That's what they do. They were invited into the education system to bring an entrepreneurial spirit. And now they're gaming it, and many of them are making they're making boatloads of money. And the problem isn't necessarily the management companies, it's the legislators. We need legislation that puts in place the right incentives. For example, these for-profit companies, they focus on lower elementary students because they get the same amount of money, whether it's a high school student, middle school, or lower elementary. So they game the system.
Because lower elementary students are going to be less expensive than a high school student?
Exactly. Often they don't provide transportation. The money is included in the funding they get, but why provide transportation when they're not required? If you provide transportation, it costs more money, and it also invites more low-income students into your school or may facilitate that. So we see across the board that they game the system, and yet, that's what they're doing. That's what they're supposed to do. We shouldn't be surprised that they're making boatloads of money. But what we need are the right incentives in place, and we need the safeguards in place. Without those, they have free rein. And what we see is that they are refusing to share information because they're private. They're playing by the rules, and they're using the rules to their advantage. What we need to do is look at those, again, the incentives and the guidelines, make sure they're in place so that if we're going to have them operating in the public school system, that they can still bring that entrepreneurial spirit and use it to improve the public schools in the taxpayers' best interest and not in their stockholders' best interest.
Gary Miron, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
Gary Miron is a professor of education, leadership, research, and technology at Western Michigan University. Links to the Detroit Free Press series on charter schools and an essay for Bridge Magazine critical of that series can be found at wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.